Since everybody's given a little bit of your background, let me tell you a little bit about mine. I'm a biologist at Washington University School of Medicine, which is in St. Louis, not Washington. And I'm in the genetics department there. I've been there for about a year and a half. Before that, I was for 25 years at the University of Colorado. Before that, I was an undergraduate at Caltech, where I actually started out as a physics major. And so I took 2 years of physics and mathematics at the undergraduate level at Caltech, which is pretty rigorous. I mean, more so than most biologists get, I think, before I switched to biology. So I have some background in physics anyway, and ability to speak to physicists. I've been accused on more than one occasion of thinking like a physicist. At least by some of my biologist friends. Anyway, when Terry invited me to get involved in this whole program, I was really delighted. I've had a little bit of experience on similar things, although ITP is, of course, a unique institution. But for a couple of years, I was involved in summer programs that lasted 2 or 3 weeks at the Aspen Center for Physics, where mostly biologists would come in and there would be some interaction with physicists, although it was mostly the biologists talking to each other. I also was part of a program at the Newton Institute in Cambridge, England, a couple of years ago that had a long program, again, mostly in this case aimed at mathematicians, but the idea was to get dialogue going with biologists and the mathematicians there. And that was really useful. And so if you want to know what I'm hoping to get out of this, just the very fact that I can talk to, you know, whatever it is, 30 or 40 smart people and tell them kind of problems I'm interested in and hopefully get some feedback from people who think about problems in a different way, have a different perspective and a different set of expertise, I'm hoping will help my own research area as well as hopefully get some of you interested in working on some of these kinds of problems. So the plan for today and tomorrow, I'm giving 3 lectures, this one this afternoon and one tomorrow, is really basic biology. I think Terry mentioned yesterday I was going to try to cover 1 year undergraduate introductory molecular biology in 3 lectures. And that's sort of the aim, although I'm not going to cover everything in all that much detail, but I'm going to cover a lot of what I think are the most important topics that people need to know for the rest of the program, that is for the next 4 or 5 months. Hopefully this will give you a bit of a background. It's always a little hard to know where to begin these things and what to try to cover. I'm reminded of the story of Max Delbruck, who was a physicist and who came to the United States in the 1930s and switched to the field of biology. And he's actually one of the founding fathers of the field of molecular biology. He won the Nobel Prize in the 60s for some of his pioneering work that ushered in the field of molecular biology. And when he first came here, and he had a group of physicists, postdocs working with him, and he invited Avery, who's a famous bacterial geneticist at the time, to come and talk to his physics group. And Avery asked him, well, where do I start? What do they know? What do they not know? How elementary do I have to begin? And Max's advice was, you should assume that they have zero knowledge but infinite intelligence. So that's the basic idea. I'm going to start assuming you don't know very much, but you're incredibly smart, and so I can sort of rapidly go through and give you the basics, and you'll pick it up as we go. I'm sure the zero knowledge part is an underestimate. Everybody nowadays, I mean, you can't pick up a newspaper hardly without reading about some DNA and proteins and genes, and so everybody has sort of underlying background knowledge, I think. On the other hand, what you read in the newspapers is not only incomplete, but often erroneous, and so maybe I'll correct some misperceptions. And at any point, you know, if there's questions, I have material prepared, but we can branch off on different directions. This can take all morning into the afternoon. I can rearrange what I'm doing later. So at some point you want me to elaborate on something or explain something, just ask questions. Let's make this as informal as we can. So where to start? Let me start sort of, Terry brought this up yesterday, what's called the central dogma of molecular biology. The term central dogma was coined by Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the structure of DNA, who himself was a physicist. And when asked later on why he used the term central dogma, he said, well, this scheme that I'm going to show you, it makes a lot of sense. It sort of explains a lot of things. But on the other hand, there's really very little evidence for it. You more or less have to accept it on faith. At least that was true when he first presented this idea back in the late 50s, early 60s. Nowadays, of course, there's a lot of data for it, and so it's quite well established. It still goes by the name of central dogma, and it's represented by the solid lines here, which is mostly a diagram of information flow in biology. That is, DNA replicates to make more DNA. DNA is also the template which is required for the synthesis of RNA. And then RNA in this central dogma scheme is sort of an intermediate from which the information flows from DNA through RNA to finally making the proteins. What I've shown in dotted lines here are some of the exceptions to the central dogma that have come to light in the last decades, really. It's known that some RNA viruses can replicate themselves without going through a DNA stage, and so there's actually the possibility to go from RNA to replicating RNA. There's also the existence of mechanisms by which RNA can be copied into DNA. So this is so-called reverse transcriptase. But, David Baltimore, that is now the president of Caltech, actually won the Nobel Prize for discovering that back arrow there. But anyway, this is basically the fundamental information flow in molecular biology, and that's how I'm going to sort of organize my set of lectures. I think this morning I'm going to talk primarily about DNA, something about its structure, function, how it's made. I also want to bring up some of the methodology so you understand when we talk about certain data that we have, how we obtain that data. This afternoon I'll talk more about RNA, again, what its structure, its repertoire of different structures, its functions, something about how it's made, and in particular how it's regulated. And then tomorrow I'm going to talk more about protein. One of the hardest things about learning a new field is always the vocabulary. There are just so many things that you have to have names for. And sometimes the names are fairly descriptive, so just the name itself more or less tells you what's going on. So for instance, the process of going from DNA to RNA is called transcription, and that makes a lot of sense because DNA and RNA are very similar things, and basically you're just making a copy of a piece of the DNA into a piece of RNA. So you're really just transcribing it in essentially the same language. Whereas protein is also a string. These are all strings, but it has a completely different alphabet, and so it's really a translation into a new language. It's almost like, the alphabet is freedom, is almost like translating something from English to Chinese or something, where you really have a completely new set of characters that are being used. So anyway, those names actually are fairly descriptive of what's going on. But for many of the other things, the names are just to get pulled out of the hat. And in fact, oftentimes, if you make a descriptive name, oftentimes that name gets fairly long. So then what you do is you just turn it into a set of initials, DNA or PCR or something like that. And you end up with a sort of alphabet soup. And it's really hard to know what's going on. One gets a feeling of accomplishment after a while and you start learning a new field, just like learning a new language, I guess, when you can read a paper without having a dictionary at your side there to help you understand what all the terminology is. But it's something that just takes time. And I'll try to be to not use too much jargon, but it will be hard for me not to. So if at some point something's not clear, just ask a question. Yes? Why nature needs RNA? Maybe. I don't know whether I wasn't specifically going to address that question, but might. Could you get by without RNA? You probably could. Although actually most theories of the evolution of life now think that RNA was actually first, and that RNA, because what you'll see, so in the standard dogma, DNA is the blueprint of life, it's sometimes called. Right? It contains all of the instructions. And actually I like that analogy, but you have to remember that a blueprint, or even something, let's take this building here, a blueprint is not what you normally would think of a simple one-page diagram. It's going to be multiple pages, probably a whole book full of blueprints. And not only that, they're separate blueprints for the plumbers versus the electricians versus the carpenters. Each one would have their own subset of blueprints. RNA usually is the instructions for a single gene, so it's almost like sort of a particular subset of the total set of blueprints. It's just a small copy. So for instance, there'd be the blueprint that you give to the plumber who's working on the second floor restroom, and that would be his blueprint, and that's the only thing he cares about, and he doesn't care about any of the rest of the building. And that's sort of what RNA is, it's just a little piece of that copy. And then that piece is actually get, you know, you take the blueprint, you take the information, and you actually do the plumbing, and you do the electrician, that ends up being the protein. So in that sense, you could imagine, well, it might be possible to skip this altogether and just read out one little section of this overall big giant blueprint without actually, you know, making a copy of that page for yourself. You could argue about whether that would be efficient or not, but presumably possible. However, what's been discovered is that RNA actually has a lot more functions than just this thing. There are RNAs who actually perform various functions. It used to be thought that the proteins actually did all the functions and the DNA just kept the information and the RNA was this intermediate. But there are RNAs that in fact have enzymatic functions, and I'll talk a little bit about that. In fact, it's been recently been shown this process here called translation is performed by a molecular machine called a ribosome. And it's a very big machine. Its crystal structure was just recently determined and published. And it turns out that the actual enzymatic activity whereby you link amino acids together to make the protein is actually performed by the RNA. The RNA acts as the catalyst of that mechanism. There are other things in which RNA has been found to have a lot more roles than was originally thought. While maybe it's possible that you could have gotten away with this, that's certainly not the way things have evolved. And there's now pretty good evidence and a lot of theory about the fact that RNA may have been the progenitor, since it has both catalytic activities as well as information carrying capacity. You can imagine that RNA actually existed first, and then proteins evolved because they had certain advantages in terms of catalytic activities and repertoire. On the other hand, DNA is a much more stable molecule than RNA, and so it becomes sort of a stable repository of this information over time. But that became something that happened through evolution at a later date. Chemically, it has a much longer half-life. RNA tends to fall down for reasons I'll show you in a little bit. It turns out, so the difference, DNA, of course, stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, and this is just ribonucleic acid. That extra oxygen turns out to actually make RNA fairly unstable, especially at high pH. pH above 7, it actually breaks down fairly rapidly, whereas DNA is stable. You can heat it, you can boil it, you can do all sorts of stuff, and DNA is pretty stable, whereas RNA is not very stable. So, again, I mean, I'm sure most of you know this stuff, but let me just point out the sort of fundamental thing that was discovered in the structure of DNA, the Nobel Prize-winning work of Watson and Crick, had to do with the structure of DNA. For the moment, I'm ignoring here the helical stuff and the fact that even that, you know, these are in opposite directions. There's a 5' to 3' end, so there's a polarity that Terry mentioned yesterday, and that ends up being important. But the fundamental, most important feature of DNA is this base pairing characteristic. For a single strand of DNA, it's a long polymer with only four letter alphabet, A, C, G, and T, but there are these pairing rules so that the other strand, the other polymer, these are two separate molecules, polymers, but they have this complementary rule. So if one strand has an A, the other one has a T paired with it and a CG. So there are only two kinds of base pairs, AT base pairs and CG base pairs. And when this was first realized, I mean, it's one of these facts that, in retrospect, it's so obvious you wonder why somebody didn't think of it sooner. It's a little bit like, you know, the Copernican solar system or the Bohr atom or something. It's something, you know, what a great idea, but it wasn't thought of until the crystal structure was solved and people realized it. But of course, this solves all sorts of problems. What that means that the information in this strand and this strand are completely redundant. I can take these two strands and separate them, and I can make a copy of this one and a copy of this one, and now I have two strands that contain exactly the same information, and that's exactly how replication works. That's how come a single cell can divide its DNA in two, make two copies of it, and then that cell divide in two, and you have two new cells that have the same information as the parent. Yeah, you see that stuff in RNA, and the scales of energies. It's not really bad, and when we start talking about RNA, so RNA, one of the differences is it's single-stranded. I mean, it could be double-stranded, but it's generally made as a single strand. And then it can fold back up on itself. So if I have G's and T's and A's and C's, it's somewhere in the molecule and somewhere else, they can fold back on themselves. And what you find is that you actually get G, it's U in RNA rather than T, but you get GU base pairs sometimes. And there are some other things that happen. The energy goes down. I should say the other way. I tend to think like a biologist who always thinks, you know, the higher that something is, the better it is. But physicists all know that the lower the energy, the better, right? There's this sign convention that I always have to keep in my mind. So the energy goes up if you have these mismatched pairs, but it's not so bad that you never see them. You see them occasionally. So you might see things like that. But it is a good question, and I'm actually going to get to it in a couple minutes, but let me just point out right now that, you know, what I said, well, I'm going to rip these things apart and I can then make copies of them and end up with two strands with the same information as I had initially. There is some error rate. There is a possibility that as I'm synthesizing the new strand, I accidentally put in a opposite of G or a C opposite of T or something like that. And I'll talk a little bit about those error rates, because it's not an infinite discriminatory function. There's some error rates. Okay, so the fundamental, most important feature of DNA is this complementarity between the bases. Here is a more realistic picture, I guess, showing the helical nature of the DNA with a pitch of about 10 base pairs per turn of the helix. There are two grooves in the DNA. There's a minor groove and a major groove, which are discriminated by their sizes. The backbone here is a combination of, shown better on this other picture, sugar molecules here linked by phosphates and oxygens. And that becomes important. So again, just to emphasize what it's already been stated, but now to put it in a little bit, sort of a bigger perspective. So the DNA molecules themselves can be very long. I'll talk a little bit about some of the scale issues in a few minutes, but for instance, for E. coli, it has a single chromosome, which is a circle, actually, and it's about 5 million base pairs. So this is a very long stretch of DNA. But still, the fundamental process is that when the cell is going to replicate and make two new cells, it simply has to pull apart the strands and make copies of that. And since the information is redundant, I can take these two old strands, pull them apart, and make it. What I mean by copy here is, as you understand, making the complement of it, so that the two new strands are equivalent in sequence to what the old single strand was. Just one more picture of the same point, but this actually introduces one new element, and that is that when a cell is going to replicate, it's going to copy its DNA, that usually happens at a particular place in the sequence. In E. coli, there's a single origin of replication. We have this big circle, about 5 million base pairs, and there's one part of that circle, which is the origin, which has special characteristics. There are enzymes that recognize that particular region of the chromosome. They bind there, and they start making copies, and it actually works bidirectionally. So it's making, it's copying that DNA out in both directions. So there has to be enzymes that come in and take the double strand and melt it open, and then other enzymes that come and recognize the particular sequence here and start that process. One thing that's not shown on here, and it becomes important later, I was going to bring it up later, but let me just mention it now. So the enzyme that does this is called DNA polymerase. And this is one of those terms you just learned. There's a few keys that you sort of are used to hang on to. You ever see a word that ends in ACE, A-S-E, that means it's an enzyme of some sort. Well, this is one of these characteristic names that's sort of easy to remember. It's DNA polymerase. So basically, it's an enzyme that makes DNA polymers. And there's an RNA polymerase, which is basically the enzyme that makes RNA polymers. The DNA polymerase actually needs a primer. It can't initiate by itself. It can only extend DNA given an initial primer. That primer is put down by a different enzyme called a primase. That primer initially is RNA, and then the DNA polymerase comes along and extends it, and then it goes back and basically repairs the part where the primer was initially. It turns out that very fact, that DNA polymerase always works from a primer, it doesn't initiate on its own, it turns out to be very important characteristics, which has allowed for all of the kind of DNA sequencing that goes on today. And I'll bring that up later, but I thought I'd just point that right here. What I think I'll do now is take, now that you have sort of the fundamental notion of what DNA looks like and what it's for, is sort of give you some notion about scale. So I was thinking about this last night, and I wrote down some notes. So just imagine, in terms of scale, let's imagine that this room was an E. coli. So E. coli is this little bacteria. Its dimensions are about a micron or 2 microns in length and about a micron in diameter. So if this room, I'm guessing this room is probably 10 meters by 15 meters or something like that. So it's about a 10 to the 7th scale increase. If this room were the inside of an E. coli cell. What's that? So what would the DNA look like in this room if this was the inside of the cell? Well, it would be about a centimeter thick. So something like one of these cords, extension cords, maybe a phone cord kind of thickness. And it would be 17 kilometers long, like 10 miles long. Okay, so that would be the E. coli. Remember, it's a big circle, and it would be in here. Of course, it would be it's double stranded, and it's got this helical stuff. So you can imagine what kind of a tangle that might end up with. I mean, just imagine what happens when your phone cord gets kind of how hard it is to get it. So here you've got about 10 miles of cord. That's about a centimeter thick. All inside this room. Under fast-growing conditions, that is, given optimal nutrients and everything and optimum temperature, E. coli can divide in about 30 minutes. So every 30 minutes, it's making a new cell, replicating. So that's pretty fast. If putting it on scale here, that means, remember, it's a bidirectional, so it's going at about 20 miles an hour. You know, if you were to be the enzyme and you were going to copy your DNA and doing 30 minutes, you're running along this cord at not at world record speed, but at a pretty good jogging pace, 10 miles an hour. It's 20 miles an hour total, but remember there are two replication forks. So each replication fork is running at about 10 miles an hour along the strand. But furthermore, as you're running along, you're not just running along at that pace. You're pulling the strands apart and reading what the sequence is and sticking in the new things as you go. So you're synthesizing the DNA along this strand as you're running along it. The error rate, so it's not a zero error rate, but it's actually quite low. It's approximately, the numbers vary a little bit in different systems. I think in E. coli, the number is somewhat less than 10 to the minus 6 per base pair. So if the whole genome size, 5 times 10 to the 6 base pairs, it means that per replication event, it's likely to make an error or two errors, something like that. So in other words, if I have a mother cell that divides into two cells, chances are those two cells differ at maybe one or two positions from each other. So they're not exact copies, they're almost exact copies, but there is a finite error rate. Yeah?
What is the big set of time scale for this? Every time I do a book in biology, it's a time scale.
Oh, I haven't seen it too many other times. It's partly the fact of how long it takes to replicate the circle. So there's a rate at which the polymerase can move along. And this is sort of the optimum rate that it can work at. So this is under ideal conditions where it's got plenty of nutrients around. It's able to synthesize all the components that it needs, all the nucleotides to make more DNA, to make more proteins. All this is happening simultaneously, and that's sort of the fastest you can do it. What's limiting it? It may be diffusion limit. I don't actually know, but remember, you have all these nucleotides. As I said, you're running along this DNA and you're plugging things. You're just grabbing them out of the air, right? You're running along the thing. You don't have to make them yourself. The enzyme is making them. It's just, here's an A. I'm going to stick it in, attach it to my string. I move it down one nucleotide. I need a T. I just reach out of the air and I grab it, a T. And so probably my guess is that the limiting fast is how long it takes to grab that thing and put it in. And it turns out there are actually enzymes that go faster than that. I don't know whether it's ever been done in E. coli, but there are certain viruses. There are viruses that infect bacteria, and they're called bacteriophage or usually just phage. And they were actually some of the fundamental work in molecular biology was done on. Lambda is a classic example, and T4 and so on. I used to work on T4 when I started in molecular biology. And you can actually, it's been, I don't think they were selected, I think they were just come across by accident. You can get mutants of the DNA polymerase that actually are faster than the wild type. And so one might argue that why weren't they picked up in evolution? Why aren't they the wild type? Well, when I say wild type, what I mean is what you sort of the natural thing that you find in the environment, which one usually presumes is optimized in some sense, especially since this is a mutation that occurred spontaneously, so it had to have occurred, you know, millions of times through the course of evolution. Why didn't it take over the population since it replicates faster? It turns out that it replicates, it's not a huge amount faster, 2 times faster or something like that, but it increases the error rate. So there apparently is some kind of trade-off between how fast you can do something and how accurately you can do something. You can also, there also are polymerases, the DNA polymerase, you can also select them that have smaller error rates that make, actually have quite a bit less error rate than that, but they go slower. So I don't know exactly what the physics is that connects those two things, but there is a connection that lets you, I mean, one of the things is these polymerases, as they're going along, there are multiple ways in which error is corrected. Sometimes if they shoot along the DNA, and they've left errors behind. There are other enzymes that sort of scan along and they can recognize errors and correct them with repair mechanisms. But the polymerase itself actually has what's called a proofreading or editing probability, and is immediately after it's put in a base pair, if it's put in a wrong one, it can back up and take it out and do it again. So when I was talking about, you know, running along at 10 miles an hour, while I was doing this, not only it's putting in, but it's actually checking what it did, you know, putting behind it, and if it, oops, made a mistake, it'll back up and correct it and then go on again like that. So it's actually a mostly forward, but occasionally a backward process as well. And these enzymes that go faster that have higher error rates, basically what they've done is they've lost their proofreading mechanism. Yeah. Yeah, well, I meant to put in an A here and I put in a G instead. Okay, so I had a T on this strand and I'm supposed to have an A coming here. I had a G go in there and I go along, and if I don't correct that, then in the next round, when we separate again, this T will probably get an A next to it, but this G will now get a C. So in the next round, I've created a mutation. I've changed an AT base pair from the parent to a GC base pair in one of its progeny. I was going to talk a little bit, I mean, Thursday afternoon and Friday morning are a set of lectures about evolution. And I was going to go into a little bit, although it's hard not to talk even in basic molecular biology, to talk about evolution a little bit. So let me actually bring this thing up here. So, That's the total error rate at the end. So that's combining everything. No, I don't know. I don't know that process. That's a good question, but I don't know the answer. To some extent, but it's not clear that in vitro you really have all of the components like they are in vivo. So I think it has been studied to some extent in vitro, but these error numbers I was coming up with, 10 to the minus 6th, 10 to the minus 7th, those are the final error products from in vivo experiments. Yeah, the error rate in humans is actually somewhat less. I've heard numbers as low as 10 to the minus 8 error rates. But of course, the genome now is 10 to the 9th instead of 10 to the 6th. So if your error rate is 10 to the 8th, now you're making 10 errors per generation. Instead of only one or so per E. coli. So even though the error rate has actually decreased, the genome is that much bigger that you actually make more errors per generation. But comparable numbers. I mean, somewhere in that order, 10 to the 6th, 7th, 8th, that's the range of numbers that I think exist in pretty much all systems. And now there are some systems in which they have very high error rates. The AIDS virus is the classic example now, in which the error rate is something like 1 in 1,000, which is the whole reason that these things escape the immune system, is because they're constantly mutating themselves. And so, your body tries to build up, the AIDS virus is a special case, because not only is it avoiding the immune system by continually changing itself, so it's not being recognized as being this foreign object, but in fact, it's also attacking the immune system directly. And so it's simultaneously inhibiting the ability of the body to respond to an infection, but at the same time, it's also mutating fairly rapidly. So it's... That's another reason. I think the inherent error rate is equally distributed. so that raised another point, which I was going to get. This is a pretty schematic slide here, but let me just point out what I was going to say. So as I was mentioning, in optimum conditions, an E. coli can divide about every 30 minutes. So that says if I took a single cell, and I put it in a test tube. Well, it had to be a giant test tube, and it never ran out of nutrients and stuff. And I let it go for 24 hours. Would have gone through 48 doublings. So this is my single cell, and this is coming back a day later and looking at it. I've got 2 to the 48 guys down here at the bottom. 2 to the 48 is about 10 to the 15th, something like that. Big number of cells in a short period of time. If the error rate is, let's say it's on average, going from a mother cell to the two daughter cells, each of these has one change from the mother. And these two would be different. So these two daughters would differ from each other by about two mutations. And then down here, these two here and here would differ by two mutations, but they would differ from these guys over here by four mutations. When I get down to the end here, I've got 10 to the 15th different cells, each of which is different than every other cell. None of them are exactly the same. You might say, well, since this, I have 10 to the 15th different guys, and the whole genome is only 10 to the 6th, haven't I sort of saturated the genome in mutations? Well, in fact, I haven't, because if I count from this cell up to the root, that's 48 steps up here, 48 steps back down. So any guy on this half and any guy on this half only differ on average by about 96 mutations out of 6 billion possible positions. So that actually the number of positions that have changed is relatively small, but what happens is there's so many different combinations you can get. So all of these 10 to the 15th guys are likely to be different from every other one, but differ at a relatively small number of positions out of all the possible positions that there might have been, that there are. Well, so, and that was the other point I was about to get to. So most of the mutations, well, so let me just answer your question more directly. So let's suppose that one of these mutations ended up knocking out a protein. The protein didn't work anymore. That is, then that, obviously that cell would die and its whole lineage down from that wouldn't exist, right? But in fact, most mutations are completely neutral. They have neither benefit nor, they're not advantageous. There's a small fraction that are actually advantageous. Of course, what you mean by advantageous depends on what the environment is. So for instance, if these cells were just growing in sort of an optimum environment, maybe the so-called wild type, but remember when I'm looking at these cells are all different. So the wild type cell is really sort of an average of a whole bunch of individuals and sort of what they have in common. That may be sort of optimum. On the other hand, if there was an antibiotic introduced in the solution, that would change what the optimum is. And so one of these guys along the way here suddenly became more resistant to the antibiotics, so it could grow at a faster rate or something in the presence of the antibiotic, then it could rapidly take over the population. But again, the vast majority of mutations that happen are completely neutral. They don't have one effect one way or the other. And that's why over time it just becomes a stochastic process. I mean, you can think of evolution itself, it's a Markovian process where at every point here you're moving here, there's some probability of changing any base pair or anything. It's a zero order Markov process because you don't have any memory, you just go from this step to the next step. There's some probability of repeating exactly what was in the DNA sequence, or some probability of replacing it with something else. But this Markovian process is duplicating itself at every point along. So I had one cell that became two, and now each one of those is initiating a new process. Yeah, there's a lot of direct. I mean, you can sort of get that just by looking at the sequences, and you can see which positions are important and which ones aren't. But also, there's quite a bit of direct evidence that if I just sequence things from a population that seem to be growing normally, I end up with all these mutations scattered about it. It doesn't. By any criteria of, you know, has it had a deleterious effect? You can't measure anything that seems deleterious about it. But that actually will become more clear when we talk about what's actually in the DNA sequence. Most of the positions in the DNA sequence don't actually matter very much, or in the terms of human, really matter at all. You've heard the terms junk DNA. I'll get to that a little bit later. But human DNA is 90% quote junk. Right? Maybe this is a good point to bring up the statement I like that Sidney Brenner makes. He wants to make clear the distinction between junk and garbage. Garbage is that stuff that you put out at the curb and the truck comes along and hauls it away. Junk is what you keep up in your attic because you never know when you're going to want it. You know? So I think this junk DNA is mostly DNA that we don't know what its function is. It's there. It gets passed on, all that kind of stuff, but we don't know if it has no function, or maybe it has a function, but we just simply don't know what it's for. But it hasn't, but we've kept it. We haven't gotten rid of it, it hangs around, so it's junk, stuff up in the attic. We don't know, we haven't measured any effect, and in fact, in many cases you could argue, well, there really isn't going to be any effect, just from sort of first principles, as I get to a bit later. But in most cases, you could say if you measure it, it clearly doesn't have any effect. If you look in the population of people, I mean, is there, what I would consider to be a neutral mutation is, you know, whether I have blonde hair or dark hair. Those are mutations in the sense that at some point there was an ancestor that had one hair, and now people have lots of different colored hair. Does that make a difference? I mean, it has no effect on the survivability of a person whether they have dark hair or light hair. You probably have to know something about how it spreads, although for many things you could just look at it and say this is likely to have no effect. When we start talking about protein synthesis, you'll see that some positions are called silent positions because I can change that position without changing the amino acid that goes into the protein. Yep, right, there are stretches like that. And you know, so those would be neutral mutations. The question back there. Sure. And that's what I meant actually by most of them have no phenotype. That is, phenotype, what you mean by what you observe about something. Anything that you could measure about something would be its phenotype. With modern techniques, sometimes it's hard to distinguish, actually make the distinction between genotype, which is the actual changes in the DNA, and phenotype, which is some measured thing, since we can actually go down and measure the DNA. Is that a change in genotype or a change in phenotype? But generally, what you mean by phenotype is some sort of outward characteristic that you would measure about something. And most mutations don't affect the phenotype at all. And then there are other ones that do affect the phenotype, but they're not in any measurable sense deleterious or advantageous. I mean, you could argue that you know, based on mate selection criteria, that you know, being blonde or something might be better or worse depending on your culture, and all that kind of stuff you could argue about. But overall, in terms of the fundamental survivability, it doesn't matter whether you have blue eyes or brown eyes. Okay. Good question. And it's really not known. So for E. coli, which has this 17 kilometers of DNA in a room this size, it's not known whether it's organized in any particular structure. And if you look at the pictures of E. coli, which you can sort of visualize the DNA, it just seems like it's just a big jumbled mess. But it's not clear whether there is some sort of underlying organization characteristics or not. The other thing is that when the cell divides, so bacteria, one of the characteristics of bacteria is there, inside of it is just this big image called the cytoplasm. There's no separate nucleus where the DNA resides. It's all, everything is together in one place. And so I've got this 17 kilometers of DNA. I've just gone through this process of replicating it, and now I have two strands, and now when the cells divide, what it's going to do is it's going to make a septum right down the middle of this room. And now I'm going to have two separate rooms, and those rooms will then go on and increase in size, and that will repeat over and over again. But at the time that the septum gets made, I have to make sure that one of those two 17-kilometer strings of DNA is all on this half, and the other 17 kilometers is all over in this half. And how that exactly happens is not really well understood. But it's clearly, since these are, you know, as they're being made, remember that it's this helical structure. I showed you some of these pictures here. It's not exactly clear, you know, how you resolve these two things into two separate entities that eventually become separated by a cell wall between them. Well, there are break and repair mechanisms, so they can break. In fact, there are enzymes, so part of this thing about unraveling it and make sure is there are actually enzymes that called topoisomerase that will break one strand at a time and let it, you know, unravel so you don't end up with huge supercoiling problems. So there are actually enzymes involved in doing a controlled break and repair process. Otherwise, you could imagine it would be incredibly tangled. So there is actually a process, enzymes involved, topoisomerases, which go along with the replicase in front of it, and they make sure that things get unwound and resolved. But there are a number of things that are not known about that process, but there are a number of things that are known about it as well. Right, you have to make sure of that. And in fact, that's one of the functions of these topoisomerase genes, is they can take two interlocked circles, and they can basically pull the DNA across one by breaking it and then rejoining it on the other side. So there are mechanisms to resolve those kinds of circles. Do errors happen in that process? Occasionally, No, I think it's pretty small, but they can be very deleterious. So in bacteria, I don't know how often that happens. I've never seen a measurement of it. It might be a little hard to measure it, actually. But those are the kind of things, it's a process similar to that, even though in humans, the chromosomes aren't circular, they're linear, but they're very, very big, and they do undergo, during the replication process, they also undergo exchanges where they crossover, they basically do genetic exchange across it. And sometimes those things don't get resolved, and so in the process of cell replication, you actually end up with where one chromosome should go to this cell and one chromosome should go to this cell. In fact, both of them go to one cell and the other cell gets none. And those are very deleterious effects. And things like Down syndrome have to do with, it's called non-disjunction. So you end up with three copies. In the end, you end up with three copies of chromosome 22 instead of only two copies of chromosome 22. Now, if you do that with most chromosomes, you're simply dead. You don't survive at all. There are only three chromosomes, I think, for which you survive at all. And the least severe is the Down syndrome, chromosome 21 trisomy. It's the least severe of all those chromosome abnormalities. I think chromosome 18 children will actually be born and survive a few years, so they tend not to live very long. Any of the other chromosomes, if you end up with one of these non-disjunction events, basically, it's lethal during gestation. So they lead to spontaneous abortion. So at one level, you could say that the underlying mutation rate has to do with this energy difference. What's the probability of these two things coming together and making a pair? And that should, you think, would be the same. And I don't know exactly what that is. Somebody asked the question earlier, and I don't know if I've ever seen it. If I have, I've forgotten it. But what that sort of fundamental difference in the energy values is for the making the correct pair versus the mismatched pairs. But then the real difference comes in at how effective you are at recognizing that and correcting it. So I said the polymerase that goes along actually has this error correcting mechanism where it will back up, remove a base, and put in a new one. So it does that at a pretty high fidelity rate by itself. But occasionally it gets by and it doesn't do that. Then there's other enzymes that basically scan along the DNA, and they can recognize when I have a mispaired DNA, and they'll chop out the DNA and replace it and repair it. And so that lowers the error rate, again, by a factor of 10 or 100, depending on the species and so on. So you're right, there is this balance, and there are these sets of procedures, mechanisms that have been evolved to try to maintain the error rate fairly low, but not to zero. I mean, it's pretty clear that you could make even more higher fidelity systems, but probably you would pay something for that. One thing you might pay in is in the speed and is rapidly replicating organisms. But in humans, you're not really limited by how fast the cells divide. It more has to do with probably the reason that we haven't evolved to a zero error rate is there's actually some advantage to having mutations, to having people change over time. So I think they're all pretty similar. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think they're all pretty similar. I mean, if you look at a whole evolutionary tree, you know, mammals and reptiles are basically two little twigs that are right next to each other. They're almost identical from an evolutionary perspective to each other. It has ways of telling the new base pair that is the new one that went in. I mean, if you just see a mismatch and you say I have a G and it should have a C here, but instead I have a G and a T. I know that's an error. The question is, well, how do I know that I should replace the T with something else versus replacing the G? Sometimes they don't, but typically they have a system, this mechanism that goes along and scans the DNA actually has ability to recognize the new strand versus the old strand. And the reason is that after the DNA has been fully synthesized, these enzymes will go along and they methylate it. They take these, what's just shown here are the G, C, and AT pairs, but actually they can add a methyl group, and a common place to add it is on a C. So you add a little methylate, and now you've recognized that this DNA is not only there, but it's in through one generation, because there's a separate enzyme that comes along later and adds these things to it. Now, when I separate this and I make a new strand, I can tell which is the new and which one's the old, because the old one is methylated and the new one is not methylated. Now, it doesn't methylate all the C's, it just does that sporadically. There's a sequence-specific enzyme that recognizes a particular sequence of DNA that will put a methyl on a C in the middle of that sequence. So it just methylates sort of sporadically along the whole strand of DNA, but it's often enough that when I see it, when I see a mismatch, I can tell which is the new strand and therefore likely to be the error, and which is the old strand. No, you can see the mutations. You can compare. First of all, there are selections you can do. You can select for things that have a change in activity or something like that. But you can also just, even looking at neutral mutations, you can go back and you can identify and sequence the DNA and see that a mutation has happened. That is, the parent DNA sequence is different than the daughter DNA sequence. And you can actually see that happening. Those are mostly, so you do the experiments in vitro where you've purified the components and you're running it in vitro, and you can monitor step by step. I mean, there are ways in which you can label different DNA antigen. Like I might label my A radioactively, or I might label it fluorescently or something like that. And so I can actually monitor when a mismatch occurs. There are a variety of techniques. Since that's not really my field, I'm not probably up to date on what the most current things that people do are. But you know, there are ways in which in vitro you can actually monitor the rate of things being put in inappropriately. When you're building this enzyme, this polymerase, like I said, it's not just a single enzyme. There are these other things that have to do with the topoisomerase that all are part of the whole process of replicating DNA. You can leave out components and sort of see what the effect of leaving something out is. You can do those kinds of experiments. Yeah. So DNA, so the backbone is very highly charged. It's not shown on here, but this is a polyanion, basically. It's negatively charged all up and down here. So it gets neutralized by salts, and mostly magnesium, divalent salts. Essentially, if I look at the picture like this, so this is showing you the naked DNA, but if I really looked at that, there would be basically a row of magnesium ions down that backbone. So the DNA itself is highly charged along the backbone. The bases themselves are generally neutral. I don't remember what the pKa's are. The pH inside of most cells is around 7. Usually, if anything, it's a little higher. It's a little more on the basic side of 7, between 7 and 8. And a half maybe is typical. That actually brings up an interesting fact that I didn't realize until the other day I was thinking about it. So remember, so the volume of an E. coli cell, if this room was the E. coli cell, the volume of an E. coli cell is about 10 to the minus 15th liters. So that means at a pH of 7, there's about 100 hydrogen ions scattered about this room. There are cells that, the smallest known cells are about 100 times smaller than E. coli. They have a volume of about 10 to the minus 17 liters. They actually are more dense with DNA because their genome size is about 1/10 as big as E. coli, but their volume is about 100. So the DNA is a much bigger fraction of the total volume. If you think about that, in most cells, a pH 7 means they have one hydrogen ion somewhere inside the cell. You're not really talking about bulk properties anymore. You're talking about single ions. Yeah, so there's this wire in here. That's what I was going to get to. So there are these machines that are involved in making protein. And a typical cell grown in not necessarily fastest growing conditions, but in sort of good growing conditions will have on the order of 10 to the 4th ribosomes in it. And the ribosomes, they're pretty big. They're about, in this room, they'd be like 10 centimeters, a grapefruit or something like that in size. So there'd be about 10,000 of those in here. In addition, there's about a million proteins of all different kinds. The ribosome is this, it's a complex. So another one of these words Psalm, anytime you see psalm, it means, I think it comes from the Greek, it means body. So chromosomes were originally noted when you stain cells and look at them in a microscope, they were different colors, and so they were called chromosomes. The bodies, colored bodies is what it meant. Ribosomes were not even seen until they started doing electron microscopy, and they were just these dense balls, and they would purify them, and they found out they were just filled with RNA. Ribonucleic acids were going to be called ribosomes. There are other kind of somes. We'll talk about spliceosomes and so on. Yeah. About 10,000 of those in here. Those are the things that, those are the machines that are actually making protein. So they're reading RNA as to get the information, and then they're synthesizing the protein that corresponds to that RNA. So most of the, so there are, in addition, maybe a million single proteins, or sometimes these proteins come together and make small complexes, but there might be a million separate protein molecules in there. On an average size, might be 2 centimeters in diameter. So, probably that part is thought to mostly be just diffusion control. That is, you make a piece of RNA. The ribosome will actually get onto the RNA as it's being made, since it's all happening in one component. Ribosomes can float around, as far as we know. They seem to more or less fill the space, more or less uniformly, I think. Very orderly. I don't know. Well, there's just one kind of ribosome. Ribosomes are the same. There's another 10 to 6 proteins. So the RNAs, there might be, in addition, what's the number I calculated? Something on the order of 10,000 RNAs. Remember, the RNA is just a copy of a piece of the DNA. A typical RNA length might be 10 meters. So there might be, from one end of the room to the other, there'd be one RNA. That codes for from one to maybe a few different proteins. And there are 10,000 of those. So in addition to this, 17-kilometer wrapped-up DNA, there's another 10,000 single-stranded things now. So they're not quite as thick as the double-stranded. So they're single-stranded, but they're about 10 meters long, and there's 10,000 of those in this room as well. And 10,000 ribosomes, a million proteins the size of, a walnut or something like that. No, each ribosome, we'll get to that later, but the main thing about the ribosome is it's a machine that takes a single RNA and just goes down along the RNA, it reads that sequence, and it says, okay, here's a certain sequence of RNA, that means I need to add an alanine, which is a piece of a protein, an amino acid. And then it scans out along and says, all right, the next amino acid is a glycine, and it starts attaching the amino acids together. And at the end, I have a string of amino acids, which is a completely different alphabet than my string of nucleic acids, but the information has been copied or translated from the RNA sequence to the protein sequence. So the RNA sequence defines what the protein sequence will be. But there's this complicated process done by the ribosome that changes languages from RNA to protein. Each ribosome, let me do this at a single time. No, that's a good question, actually. You reminded me that was one of the early questions that people didn't know the answer to, but now it's quite clear that the following process happens. So let me sort of get a better pen. Let me outline the sort of central dogma in a more schematic form. So here's my DNA strand right here, and this goes on infinitely long in both directions, right? There are signals in here that I'm going to get to later that say, here's where you start making RNA. So I'm going to take this stretch of DNA from here to here, and I'm going to copy that into RNA. So a single-stranded copy of that particular piece of DNA. What happens is this now gets made, it's floating in the cytoplasm. A ribosome will come along, and ribosomes are usually drawn like this, because in fact there are two halves that come together on the RNA. And when they come on there, then they start, it's reading along in the sequence. So as it's moving along the RNA in that direction, let's say, it's synthesizing protein corresponding to this sequence. And when it gets down to the end here, it falls off, but then it'll go back. It won't necessarily get on the same RNA, it'll get on a different RNA. So at any one time, a ribosome will be copying a single RNA and making a protein that corresponds to that sequence. And there could be multiple ribosomes per RNA. There can be multiple ones moving along simultaneously. When it gets to the end and it falls off, remember there are lots of other RNAs in here, it has its choice. It could get back on the same RNA, it could get on a different RNA. So each time it picks an RNA, let's say at random, just by diffusion, and it runs into it, and it moves along in a particular direction. This RNA also has a signal that tells the ribosome, here's where you start making your protein. So it starts there, it goes along until it comes to a stop signal. It comes to the stop signal, it falls apart, and then it looks for a new RNA to grab onto, and it does the same process over and over again. It's two balls because that's, in reality it is, there are two subunits, a big subunit and a small subunit, and they come together. They're separate until they find the RNA, and then they come together and they make a complex called the complete ribosome. The amino acids are floating around in space as well as the nucleotides from other subunits. So when it needs, the amino acids are floating around in space, but actually at the process of where they get added in here, there's another special kind of RNA called a transfer RNA, which is very important for doing this process. I'll show you a transfer RNA beginning of my next lecture. But there's enough supply around usually. There are some of the really interesting experiments that were done in the early days of molecular biology. They said, well, what happens if I starve my E. coli for alanine? Well, it turns out E. coli can make all of its own amino acids, but I can pick up mutants that don't make alanine. That E. coli is just fine as long as it has alanine in the media that it's growing in. But then I can ask, well, what happens if I leave alanine out? And I can start asking all these questions about, you know, how does it synthesize it? How does it respond to a different environment, stimuli, and all that kind of stuff? And most of these things, so it has its capability of making alanine, let's say. So alanine is just one of these amino acids. It has its ability to make that if it's not available. If I give it alanine, then it actually saves itself the work. It turns off all the enzymes that would normally be used to make alanine because it doesn't need to make them. It has plenty around. Yeah, I mean, that may be one of the things that limits the overall growth rate is how fast those things can be made. But it's not clear, you know, of all the possible rate-limiting steps, whether it's how fast you can copy the DNA or how fast you can make the proteins or whatever, the final, sort of maximum speed is doubling every 30 minutes. It could be that you could make amino acids even faster than that if you needed to, but there's no reason to because the cell can't divide faster than that anyway. So at some point, they've all sort of converged to they make things fast enough that they can all sort of progress together and make a whole new cell within 30 minutes. Some of those processes could be speeded up maybe more than others could, but there's no reason to because it wouldn't be any good. It's thought that they actually start folding immediately. So as they're coming out, you know, from one end at a time. And as the protein is coming out, it's not just going to hang out there in the breeze until the whole thing is out and then say, okay, now what do I fold up to? It's going to start folding as it goes. And that may, in fact, be important for the overall folding process, although probably not. And the argument that it's not important, this is both true of RNA and protein. So RNA also folds up into complicated structures. And there's been a controversy for a long time is, does it have to fold up as it's being synthesized? And is that actually critical for getting its proper folding, the fact that it folds from one end first? And the argument that says that that's not critical, at least for most proteins, there are exceptions to this, but for most proteins, what you can do is you can take the fully formed protein and you can denature it, either by heating it up or by putting it in various chemicals. You can denature it and then let it renature and it folds up just fine by itself. Now, there are a few proteins for which that's not true, but for most proteins it does. So that says that even though it normally does fold as it's being synthesized, that's not essential for getting the proper folding at the end. That's a really good question that I don't know the answer to. People have argued that, I'm more familiar with the RNA folding problem, I've worked on that myself. People have argued that while in fact you don't need to have it fold up as it goes, that may in fact increase the kinetics. It has evolved such that it's folding up as it goes and that increases the overall rate at which it gets into the final folded state. And that may well be true for proteins, but I don't know that it's, somebody must have thought of that and tried it, but I've never read anything about that. No, that's right. That was some of the exceptions I was referring to. There are some proteins that are specifically, they require another protein, which are these so-called chaperones. They require another protein in order to fold up properly. In fact, these other proteins prevent them from misfolding so that they can be folded properly under the appropriate conditions or under the appropriate compartment. Now, E. coli, there's just this sort of single compartment. Everything goes on at once. And when we start talking about eukaryotic cells, of course, now there are different compartments. There's the nucleus, which is where all the chromosomes are, all the DNA is, and that's where the transcription happens. That is, that's where you're making the RNA, but then the RNA has to escape from the nucleus out into the cytoplasm where the translation happens. And there are other compartments, there are mitochondria, and there are lysosomes, and all sorts of, it becomes a very complicated mixture. To put it on the same kind of scale, so if this room was E. coli, then a typical, the nucleus of a typical eukaryotic cell, let's say a human cell. When I say typical, it's not clear what you mean, because yeast is a eukaryotic cell, but it's not really a whole lot bigger than a bacterium. But let's say, and when I say a typical human cell, I mean they vary incredibly in their size. They can be pretty small down to huge neurons that have long axons and things like that. But let's just say a mean size might be, the nucleus itself might be 1,000 times bigger than E. coli cell, which makes sense because it has 1,000 times as much DNA. So the density of DNA would be more or less comparable. These are rough numbers. I mean, I'm playing the physicist right, so you'll forgive me a factor of 10 or something, right? One way or the other. So if this room is an E. coli, then the UCSB campus is a cell, a eukaryotic cell, right? The nucleus would be 1,000 times this big, so it would encompass it. And it's not going to be a sphere, it's going to be more or less flat. At least, when you grow things in culture, they always flatten out. But even inside the body, they tend to not be compact in little spheres. They can be elongated, or they can be, depending on, you know, where they are, what tissue they're in, and so on, they can have quite different shapes. But the whole campus might be a cell, and each of these different buildings might be different compartments where different things happen. There would be one giant room, maybe the size of the library or something, the library, I'm sure, is not 1,000 times the size of this room, but it's probably 100 times the size of this room. So you could think of that as being something like the nucleus, all the books, and the books are all the genes. How's that for a good analogy? I mean, there's all these, all this information is kept in this one big giant repository, and when you want to do something, you make a copy of the part you're interested in, you take it out and you copy it, you do something with it, often in some other part of the campus. Okay? That's a question I've wondered about many times, and I've never heard a good answer. I mean, I've always thought that actually ribosomes are probably very stable, because remember, it needs, in a sort of a cell growing under pretty good conditions, maybe not optimal, it's got 10,000 ribosomes, and by the time it divides, it's going to have two cells, and those cells are each going to have about 10,000 ribosomes. That is, it's making 10,000 ribosomes per 30 minutes. Well, if they're turning over very fast, it's going to have to make, you know, twice that many or something. My assumption is that ribosomes, in fact, are very stable and that a single ribosome might last many, many generations. But I've never seen that addressed, and I actually went looking one time in the literature and I never found an answer. So I don't know what the half-life of a ribosome is, and I've never seen it published anywhere. Messenger RNAs, their half-life can actually be controlled. That's one of the ways in which you can regulate gene expression, is by making them have short half-lives or long half-lives. And E. coli, an average messenger half-life might be on the order of 20 or 30 minutes. It's not real long. And you can shorten that down to where some messages turn over in just a matter of a few minutes. And some of them might last for several generations. But that's the order of scale. In a eukaryotic system like human, a typical messenger RNA half-life would be on the order of many hours, let's say 8 hours or something like that. Copies of protein in the whole cell? Oh, how many copies, how many proteins will a ribosome make per messenger, Yeah. So that has to do, if I go back to this, with this rate of initiation. So one of the most important issues is controlling the rates of initiation. So this region right here we call the promoter, because it's the region of the DNA that tells this is where to start making RNA. So the cell basically has a promoter for every different gene, but they don't all fire at the same rate. They don't all have the same initiation rate. Some of them are 1,000 times more active than others, and that's because some proteins you need in huge amounts. Remember, you're going to have 10,000 ribosomes, so those proteins are, have to have at least... A ribosome is composed of about 50 different proteins as well as 3 different RNAs, so it's a big machine. Each of those 50 proteins has to exist in at least 10,000 copies per cell. So it's something that's being synthesized very rapidly, 10,000 copies per half hour. Right? There are other proteins that might only be 5 copies in the entire cell. And so those, I only need to make 5 copies of that protein per half hour. And so that can happen in two ways. I can control the rate at which the RNA is made, and then that will, in effect, control how much of that RNA exists, or how many different copies, how many different RNA copies there are of that gene in the cell. Obviously, I can control that in two ways. I can control it by the rate at which I make it and the rate at which I degrade it. And both of those things can be tuned. But for a given RNA, I can ask, you know, your question was how many proteins get made off of that RNA. It turns out that there's another initiation signal or translation, and those also have different efficiencies. So some messengers are translated very efficiently, and other ones are translated very inefficiently. So a single messenger RNA might, in some cases, only give rise to one protein before that RNA gets degraded. In other cases, a single RNA might give rise to 100 or 1,000 proteins before that RNA gets degraded. These are all tunable parameters that are, in some sense, controlled, or at least the cell has the ability to control those depending on, you know, what the environment is, how many proteins it wants of each different kind. I mean, the difference... So when we're talking about E. coli, we're talking about more or less a homogeneous cell type. When we're talking about a human, not only does the human body have something like on the order of 10 to the 15th different cells in it, but there are lots of different kinds of cells, muscle cells, and, you know, and neurons, and all these kinds of cells, and they're distinguished because they make different subsets of proteins. And so you control in each cell how many proteins you're making by controlling a whole bunch of these steps, the rate at which different genes are, the rate at which the RNA is made for different genes, the rate at which that RNA is translated, the half-life of the message, and also the half-life of the protein. All of those things are tunable within certain ranges. Sorry, there were 3 questions. Proteins also have half-lives. They degrade, and you can, in fact, change that. There are some proteins that are involved. They're called cyclins because they're involved in the cell cycle. So the cell, you know, a cell goes through this cycle where it replicates its DNA. Not a bacteria. Bacteria is more or less, especially if it's growing rapidly, more or less replicating its DNA all the time and just dividing as fast as it can. A typical human cell, it takes about something like 8 hours to replicate the entire DNA complement. But the cell might only divide every 24 hours. Or some cells, in fact, only divide once and they quit dividing. But a typical cell that keeps dividing might divide once every day, a rapidly dividing cell. Other cells would divide once every week or something like that. So it's a much slower process. And it's partly regulated by these proteins that are cyclins. Cyclins get made, and that's basically a signal to replicate the DNA. And when they replicate the DNA, then you attach a signal to this cyclin protein that degrades the protein, and it stays turned off until some new signal is. So there's actually ways in which you can regulate the half-life of the proteins. But all proteins have some half-life. And it's not clear in every case if that's due to some particular mechanism that's specific to that protein, or is just general, you know, breakdown. You know, entropy takes over at some point and things start falling apart. There's I don't know exactly what aging means at the molecular level, but at some point, you know, proteins, they absorb ionizing radiation or something and they get it damaged, and then the cell has a way of clearing out damaged proteins, recognizing that they're damaged and getting rid of them. Okay. Yeah, I am going to get to that later. So there's, like I said, there's a signal in the DNA called a promoter that tells where to start making the RNA, and then there's also a signal that tells where you stop making the RNA. In the DNA sequences, yes. Right. There's codes in the DNA sequence. Yeah. There's probably an overall global control that sort of sets a maximum, but then you can target specific messenger RNAs to be degraded rapidly, more rapidly than others. Partly that's encoded in the structure of the RNA. There are certain structures, usually at the 3' end of the RNA, that is the tail end of the RNA. There's a structure there that sort of inhibits enzymes that come along and chew up the RNA and slows that process down. But you can also have proteins that bind to an RNA and either increase its half-life or even decrease its half-life. So again, it can be tumor. In some sense, the information for the lifetimes is encoded in them too. But that's usually an interactive process, so it's not encoded. It doesn't usually self-destruct it. It interacts with something else, and so it has, there's a signal that gets recognized by something else, but that's encoded in there too. So here's just a table I pulled out that talks about the components of a typical E. coli cell, and these are the number of different kinds of molecules, but maybe interesting what we're talking about here is the percent weight. So remember the DNA, I talked about this 17 kilometers of DNA in this room. That only represents about 1% of the total mass of the cell. I have about six times that much of the RNA. Larger amount of that RNA is actually in the ribosomes themselves. Remember, the ribosomes are made up of a substantial chunk of RNA, as well as lots of proteins. 70% water by mass. There's lots of, you know, inorganic ions, salts of various kinds, and then intermediates. So these are all the nucleotides and amino acids and everything that are going to, and sugars and all that kind of stuff that are used for energy or used for building blocks. All that represents a couple percent of the total mass. So lipids. So what we talked about is the inside of this cell, or what's going on inside. But if I actually look at the surface, so this is a picture not from an E. coli cell, but it's not a whole lot different. So there's this membrane. You think of the walls of this room as being the membrane that holds the cell. It's about, in our analogy here, it's maybe 1 or 2 centimeters thick, and it's just these are basically hydrocarbons with charged or polar head groups on them. So the hydrocarbons come together because they're trying to avoid water, hydrophobic, and then the polar head groups are sticking out into the water. So there's water, obviously, this would be the inside of the cell, and this would be the outside of the cell. But this is just this little grease. It's this greasy membrane, about 2 centimeters thick, which would be the wall that encapsulates all of this cell. And then E. coli actually has, on the outside of this membrane, it actually has a cell wall, which is basically polysaccharides, so starch covering the whole thing. It's sort of a, you know, like an M&M with a hard shell around it. How dense are they? I couldn't find one. I was looking for it. A picture, an EM picture of a E. coli. But it's basically, it's not impermeable. It has holes in it so things can get in and out. But it's a pretty rigid wall around it. This is the membrane. Density of so what's represented here, this is the membrane. And these are proteins. There are some proteins that are sort of stuck in the membranes, or some proteins that get shoved out, so they'll float around outside. And like, so this would be the inside. What's the density of integral membrane proteins? That's a good question again, and I don't actually know the answer. If you look at, I've seen EM pictures of eukaryotic cells where they looked at the surface, and this would be typical representation. That is, if the size of a protein is like this, remember I said in my analogy that a typical protein, its size in here might be 1 or 2 centimeters in diameter, and maybe the spacing between them would be 3 or 4 times that big. So it's actually pretty dense in terms of protrusions that you see on the membrane surface. And they're presumably, I mean, in fact, there's been demonstrated that these can diffuse, and you can demonstrate that in various ways. You can label them in some ways, and you can show that the label transfers either by fluorescence transfer kind of experiments or other kinds of things where you can show that if I insert something in the membrane here and I insert something else someplace else, that they have some probability of running into each other. They have a variety of functions. In some cases, there are these things that represent pores, and they're a way to get in big molecules. I mean, water can more or less diffuse through here, although it obviously forms some sort of a barrier, but there's always some probability that a water molecule can just jump across that barrier. But for big molecules, like I said, if they're amino acids in the environment, the cell would prefer to take them up rather than synthesize its own. And there are pores that allow that kind of thing. These are usually gated things where it allows something of a certain size and a certain charge to get through and nothing else, so it sort of control what's getting in and out. Other ones that are like this, they might present on the surface some I don't know what they might be doing. They might be avoiding some protection or something. There are other ones that, that extend, they're not pores, but they actually extend through, and these are actually sometimes things that, that make, have a sensory, they can attach to something in the environment, and they can tell you that, you know, there are poisons out there, or there are good things out there, and they basically then provide a signal to the inside of what the environment is like. Terry talked yesterday about the fact that these E. coli could swim around, and furthermore, they can sense their environment, and they know when they're swimming in a good direction versus a bad direction, and they can alter their direction, so that they tend to swim up a good gradient and down a bad gradient, a gradient of a bad thing, that swim away from it. And so there are, that's mostly mediated by proteins that stick through the membrane. They have receptors on the outside that will specifically bind certain chemicals, and then they, on the inside, they have a tail that responds. So when something binds out here, it causes a change in structure probably on the inside, and that can be recognized by other signaling proteins on the inside. So I've mostly been talking about E. coli, just sort of as a frame of reference. There are a set of model, these organisms that have basically been studied for a long time for various reasons. E. coli is sort of the workhorse for most early molecular biology because it was so easy to manipulate. It grows so fast. You can select mutants, all that kind of stuff. Of course, if you want to work on eukaryotic cells, then bacteria aren't that relevant. The simplest eukaryotic cell are these yeast cells. These are the size of their genomes. You notice that it's basically a factor of 1,000 going from E. coli to human or mouse. These simple eukaryotes are only, you know, 2.5 times bigger than E. coli. But this is just a single cell. A yeast is just a single cell organism. So in some sense, it's not a lot more complicated than E. coli. C. elegans is a worm, a nematode. It's a multicellular organism. It has nerves. It has muscles. It has it senses its environment. It can, has lots of behaviors that you can study. Drosophila, of course, is the fruit fly. It's not only multicellular, but it goes through all these interesting developmental stages, and it makes wings, and it has all sorts of complicated behaviors. Those genomes are 20 to 30 times bigger than E. coli. I got this slide out. This was, I think I, this original stuff was published in 95, and this was when people were first talking about, or not when they were first talking about it, but the Human Genome Project was getting underway, and they were estimating when these different genomes might be completed. And then this is when they actually were completed. So most of them were completed well ahead of schedule. In fact, if you read the newspapers, you know that the human genome has been completed, although it hasn't really. But there's a so-called rough draft of the human genome, which, so it's probably 90% complete or something like that as of last year, well ahead of the schedule that was put out in 1995. You can also ask some... Yeah, that's... right. Variability. That goes back to that picture I put up of the evolution of humans. Of evolution of E. coli. You can sort of think of the same thing in humans. So, you know, at every generation, there are going to be a few changes from the top. And at the end, if I take any two humans, in opposite parts of the globe who haven't shared a common ancestor since, 100,000 years ago or something, they're still going to be 99% identical. And there are some positions that are more variable than others, and those are key things. They're key things for a lot of reasons. I mean, certainly for forensic things, there are these so-called, you can make a fingerprint of a particular human being, which is going to be unique for many other human beings on the planet, unless they happen to have an identical twin, because there are these regions, there are some regions that are sort of hypervariable and other regions that are more conserved. So any two individuals are going to have different DNA sequences, but they're going to be 99% identical. That's probably 99.5 or so percent identical. I don't think he sequenced his own DNA. It's actually not true that a single person has been sequenced. So I think at Venter's group, I think they initially they collected DNA from six individuals, I believe, and sequenced that together. In the more public one, which has been spread out amongst a lot of different centers, each one working on different chromosomes or so on, they have shared some DNA sequences, but they've also gotten some of their own. So it's actually a mixture of more than one person. But in fact, one of the most interesting questions, and one of the reasons that the sequencing centers are not going to go out of business anytime soon, is one of the interesting things is what is the variability amongst people? So you want to not only know what the average sequence is or the typical sequence, but how much it varies and how much it varies at different positions, what the effects of those variabilities are. I mean, we know some of the effects, like I mentioned before, blue eyes, brown eyes, blonde hair, all that kind of stuff. Those are sort of phenotypic variations, tall, short, all those kinds of things. But the more interesting variations have to do with, you know, susceptibility to diabetes, susceptibility to heart disease. There are all these things that are have diseases that have genetic components, and we won't really understand that until we have some notion of what particular DNA sequences are associated with what particular diseases, how prevalent they are in the population, and furthermore, how they interact with each other. You know, there are all kinds of interesting questions like that that we're just really starting to get a handle on. It's the longest one that's been sequenced to date. It's not the biggest genome. There are genomes, there are salamanders that are, I forget if it's 20 or 50 times bigger than the human genome. Now, I don't think they're more intelligent, and so it's unlikely that genome size is directly related to intelligence. The other thing is, I was going to then say, well, how many genes do these organisms have? So these are the genes in, you know, times 1,000. So E. coli has roughly 4,000 genes, and Cerevisiae has about 6,000 genes. For a long time, the number floating around for humans was, oh, it probably has 80,000 or 100,000 genes. Based on the sequence that exists now, which is pretty complete, that number has been reduced dramatically to around 35,000 genes. Really, you know, twice the number of a fruit fly or a worm. Now, it turns out that the more and more we learn, it turns out that the definition of a gene is not quite so clean as we once thought. That in fact, so part of the reason that this number has been reduced is it depends exactly on how you define it. A single piece of DNA may code for more than one protein, and so the question is, are those really separate genes, or is it the same sort of variations of the same gene, and exactly how you count it. This number 35,000 really corresponds to single pieces of DNA that in some cases may code for more than one protein. Sorry, what was your question? How do you count them? In E. coli, it's really easy to recognize genes. They have very characteristic features. You can just look at the DNA sequence and you can recognize where the genes are. The same is pretty much true in yeast. If you go more higher up, it's a little more complicated to tell. And so that's why this number is 35, probably plus or minus 5, something like that. Partly because they're not so easy to recognize. Just by looking at the DNA sequence, you can't always tell where a gene is. There are ways to experimentally go out and find a piece of RNA. And this number is an extrapolation. This number was originally published because it was much lower than previous estimates. This number was originally published by Phil Green, who's going to be here in a month or so. And what he did was he took the first complete chromosome that was sequenced, was chromosome 22, and he did a very thorough analysis and he estimated the gene density and so on. And then he knows relative sizes of all the other chromosomes. So if chromosome 22 is typical of all human chromosomes, you can extrapolate and say the total number of genes is roughly 35,000. And as more and more data has come in and we now have, you know, more and more complete sequence, that number is holding up pretty well. So that just says that chromosome 22 is fairly typical and the total number of genes is probably 35,000. Previous estimates have been based on people pulling out little pieces of RNA, the so-called EST sequencing projects. So EST stands for a expressed sequence tag. So if I take my cell and I just yank out some RNA and I start sequencing those RNAs, first of all, I don't get the whole sequence. I only get about 500 base pairs at a time, because that's how much sequence I can get in one read. And I do that over and over again. Well, it turns out that I may have, and I may line them up and I try to calculate how many genes there are. I end up with maybe 100,000 different things. That also includes some amount of extrapolation, sort of a Poisson of, you know, how many. What fraction of things that come in are new, I can extrapolate to how many are out there altogether. The problem is that it is difficult in that way to tell if I got one piece of a gene, one piece of RNA that had a certain sequence, another piece of RNA had a different sequence. How do I know that these aren't actually part of the same gene and I'm just missing the piece in between that connects them? And that happened actually quite a bit. There's also the fact that, remember, this has to do with the definition of a gene. I have a single piece of DNA. It can code for more than one gene. And if I count that as just one gene, the RNAs, in fact, might be different, and I might not have recognized that early on. So I might have called it two genes. Some people argue, well, that really is two genes, even though they come from the same piece of DNA. So if I use that definition of a gene, then this number might be off by a factor of too low. It really might be 70 or 80,000 genes if I call multiple proteins from a single piece of DNA a separate gene. So again, it's a little bit semantics there. By a process called alternative splicing, which I'm going to get to this afternoon. So let me put that answer that, because it's a complicated process, but it's actually much more prevalent than people thought. People first discovered alternative splicing maybe 10 years ago. I thought, oh, this is some rare event that occurs really in special cases. It was just first discovered, actually, I think, in Drosophila, where there's a single gene that can give rise to two different RNA products, and those products are actually involved in sex determination. So if you're a male, you have one product, and if you're a female, you have another. So I thought, well, this is some kind of specially evolved thing. What's happened is now it looks like in human, maybe half of the genes are alternatively spliced. That is, half of the genes can give more than one product. But let me put that off for later. Let me go back to the initial issue of DNA. What I said in, am I allowed to be right within an order of magnitude? In that case, I'll say yes, definitely between 1,000 and 100,000. I don't know, that's a good question. And a lot of those genes are families. The genes have been duplicated through evolution, and so I have multiple copies of genes that do more or less the same thing, or maybe they're related, although they've evolved slightly different functions. If I compress those into say, well, this is a gene family and this is a gene family, how many different families are there? 1,000 might be a good estimate, but I don't really. I wouldn't stake a very large wager on that, but that's probably a reasonable estimate. So there have been some really interesting papers that have been published where, as these new genomes come out, and by the way, this is just a very small smattering. Yesterday, Terry put up a list of 30 different bacterial genomes that have been completely sequenced, and there are maybe a dozen archaeobacteria, which is a whole other kingdom, but it's similar to bacteria, and then this is pretty much all the eukaryotes that have been sequenced, although there are big chunks of some plants, like Arabidopsis is mostly sequenced. Maybe it's complete now. I think it's just finished. Anyway, so people have asked the question, are there genes, how many genes occur in eukaryotes that don't occur in bacteria? What fraction? And things that have been newly invented by the eukaryotic lineage of the evolutionary tree. And it's a relatively small fraction, maybe 10 or 20% of the total genes occur in eukaryotes that don't occur there. But now as you move up the eukaryotic, looking at more and more complicated, going from single-celled to multicellular things, there are whole new families that exist that didn't exist before. There are families having to do with various kinds of receptors, families related to immune system genes. So essentially all vertebrates have immune system genes, and none of the invertebrates have them, and so there's all sort of a whole new invention. But the number of new inventions is actually relatively small. Per sort of branching of the tree, you'll end up, somewhere along the line, you'll invent a new family of proteins, and then that will proliferate into lots of similar but distinct members. The individual new families is relatively small. I couldn't put a number on it exactly, but I can point you to some papers by Eugene Koonin, who also I think is going to be here later in this semester, and some other people who've done some of those kind of comparisons. But if I were to make a rough estimate, and you should just not hold me to this, but my guess is that probably 90% of the gene families in humans also occur in coli. There's this fundamental process of life where everything has to, metabolize sugars and make amino acids and make nucleic acids, and that ends up being conserved in pretty much everything. I skipped over this slide, but this is a picture from one of the textbooks. This is just sort of a picture of basic metabolism that basically every cell does. And what this picture represents is each of these dots is a chemical compound. Over here on the right, I've blown up this little part that I outlined here. So each one of these dots represents a particular chemical compound, and each of the lines represents an enzyme. There's a protein that's involved in converting one chemical to another chemical. So this is a network of basic metabolism that basically every cell carries out. And so all of these proteins are more or less conserved for evolution. Now, in some cases, some cells might be missing a little part of this because, you know, humans don't synthesize all their amino acids. That's why you synthesize something like 12 out of the 20 and the other 8 you have to have in your diet, whereas E. coli can synthesize all 20 amino acids. So, you know, there are little bits and parts that are different, but basically this is a network of important compounds that basically exist in all organisms and the enzymes involved in converting them. And that is sort of conserved all the way through evolution. And there are lots of other things like, you know, yeast don't have muscles and they don't have neurons. And so there's a whole set of proteins that are unique to those particular functions that have been evolved as the lineages have diverged. But my guess is that that represents a relatively small fraction of the total number of proteins, maybe 10%, but that's just, I'm just pulling that out of the air. So in eukaryotic systems, unlike the prokaryotic ones, we don't simply have this sort of big, you know, 10-mile-long piece of DNA floating in the cell. Remember, there's a nucleus that sort of holds all the DNA. It turns out that the DNA is organized in this hierarchical structure where this is the raw, just the raw DNA helix, and it gets wrapped around these things that are called histones, wrapped up, and then those histones themselves come together into more complex structures, and then those come together. And so when you look in a microscope at a chromosome, what you're really looking at are these really condensed stretches of DNA. And that's nice in terms of it sort of makes things unique. And you can look in a microscope, especially during mitosis, when the chromosomes are the most, that is right in the middle of cell division, the chromosomes are condensed down to their smallest. And you can actually visualize them, and you can see one chromosome from another, distinguish one chromosome from another. It's not just a mixture of things. It makes it sort of nice to imagine how replication goes on. But remember, when it's replicating, it has to go back and basically untangle this whole mess, undo all of the structure, make two copies, and then recondense it again. And the same thing is true when it's going to go through this process of transcription. That is, when it's going to copy a certain section of the chromosome and to make a copy of RNA out of that, it somehow has to sort of undo all of this overall structure to get back to the raw DNA sequence, so that it can read out that sequence, make a copy of an RNA, and then, you know, somehow it's going to condense back up. How does it know which part to transcribe? That's the $64,000, or the, I guess the $1 million question. That, you get to be a millionaire if you get that one right. That's one of the big unknowns. I mean, there are certainly signals. There were signals I talked about before, promoters, but embedded in here. Which regions to unwind? That is one of the key questions that people don't know. Parts of it have to do with there are signals involved in methylation, but exactly what drives that signal? What is the underlying fundamental difference between the regions of the DNA that are condensed and therefore essentially inactive in terms of gene expression versus the ones that are open and exposed? And what those fundamental processes are is not well understood at all. Well, in total, the total amount of DNA that gets transcribed is probably 10%. It's not one part in a million. It's 10% of the whole genome is expressed as, at a given point in time, it might be, it's not going to be one in a million. It might be one in a thousand or maybe even one in many different locations along the chromosomes. Right? How many different locations in a given chromosome at a given time? Probably a typical cell. So if a human genome contains 35,000 proteins, 35,000 genes, any one particular cell type, let's say a muscle cell, is probably going to be expressing, let's say, 3 to 5,000. 10% of those genes will be expressed just in that cell. Okay? So 10% of all of its possible genes, and the other 90% might be turned off. It might be higher than that, but let's say that's a number. Some cell types are much more diverse. The brain, I think, is the most diverse. It probably, it's, if you just take whole brain, which is obviously a mixture of lots of different cells and cell types, it's expressing the most complex mixture. Maybe 80% of all proteins are expressed in the brain, whereas other individual cells might express only 10 or 20% of all the possible proteins. But which 20%, of course, varies from cell type to cell type. There's some subset, the ones involved in transcription, you know, the basic metabolism that has to be expressed in all of them. These are sometimes referred to as the housekeeping genes because they're required everywhere. And then there are the specialized genes so that muscle cells have to make actin and myosin so you can do muscle movements, and neuron cells have to make neuroreceptors and all that kind of stuff. So they make certain subsets that are unique to their type, but they have a majority of them are the common ones. Were they attached to each other right here? For the most part, during cell division, they're unique. It's just a way for them to pair up and then separate. But in fact, there are these events where they actually exchange information. So you can have a break in this chromosome and a break in this chromosome, and then you trade, and so you get what are called recombinants, which aids the diversity and aids evolution. Well, its function, I think, is mostly just to keep all this huge amount of DNA manageable. It keeps it in a more or less an inert, tractable form. You can move it around during cell division. I was going to get to these later. So let me put up a slide that sort of contrasts what you're talking about. So remember, we're talking about in here's the bacterial situation. I have one chromosome, which remember in this room is 17 kilometers worth of DNA. You always, when you saw these pictures, they just draw it as it's a little simple loop inside the cell. But in fact, remember, it's the length of the DNA is about 1,000 times the length of the cell that it's in. There'd be 1,000 loops of it. Okay, it gets replicated, and then as the cell divides, somehow it has to know to get one half into one cell and one half into the other cell. Well, it's known that there are attachment points that basically attach those two, but then you still have to pull the two parts separately so that when the septum finally occurs, that one cell has a complete chromosome and the other cell has a complete chromosome. And the mechanism by which that happens is not completely understood. Eukaryotic cells, the situation is a little bit different. So this is showing you individual chromosomes that have been condensed. So this cell is about to go through cell division. So it's condensed its chromosomes down. And in fact, what's happened here is it's already replicated. So I have chromosome 1, I have two copies of it. One of them I got from my mother, one of them I got from my father. So they're just labeled A and B, but those are both chromosome 1, and I have chromosome 2. What's shown here is it's already gone through replication. So chromosome 1A, there are two copies here and two copies here. There's this complicated, again, partially understood, but certainly don't understand everything, way in which these machines attach and they separate the two chromosomes to make sure that the daughter cell gets one of each kind. It still gets two copies of chromosome 1, one of which came from the mother, one of which came from the father, but this cell gets one whole set and this cell gets one whole set. So they get pulled apart. And this is made easy by the fact that these chromosomes are all down and compact and in a more or less rigid body, I think, as you can imagine here. If these were just long extended strings, then you'd have this problem exaggerated by 1,000-fold because the chromosomes are 1,000 times bigger. So in some sense, it's a convenient way. I mean, thinking, you know, teleologically, why does it make sense that they would do this? Well, it makes them compact, easily manipulable things. I can pull them apart and separate them relatively easy. But again, it raises the problem that during the replication process, so remember, somewhere in here, there's an origin of replication. I should also say that there's in the bacteria, there's a single origin that leads to the replication of the entire circle. In eukaryotic systems, they have these big chromosomes. So an individual chromosome, it's linear, but it might be 50 times longer than an E. coli chromosome. But it has multiple origins of replication. So replication can start at multiple points. But in order for replication to start, it has to more or less unwind this so it can get down to the actual DNA sequence, read it and make copies of it and pull it apart. And then as it's pulling it apart and copying it, then it has to be recondensed. So by the time that mitosis happens, that is when the actual cell division happens, they've condensed down into these nice paired structures. And they're paired so that when this attachment happens, it knows that it's getting one of the of the two copies, one of them has to go to one pole, and one of them has to go to the other pole. And the way to make sure that happens is it pairs them to start with, and then it pulls them apart from that pair. Okay? Now this is mitosis. This is a normal cell division. There's a process called meiosis, which is similar, but this is that's going to give rise to the actual gametes, the germ cells that you pass on from generation to generation. So remember, you get a gamete that is a single copy of each chromosome from each of your parents, right? From each of your parents. So you have the diploid cell, and this is what goes through mitosis. But then, in the end, when you make your own germ cells, they're going to end up just getting single chromosomes back again that you're going to pass on to your children. But in the process, there are these so-called exchange events where I can basically take a piece of one chromosome and cut it off and stick it on the end of another chromosome. So that... Yeah, let me see if I have a slide that illustrates that. Well, sort of. So, in meiosis, you have this pairing of homologous chromosomes. In mitosis, you just have each chromosome sort of an individual event, and it gets replicated. So it's paired only with the thing that it's sister that it was replicated with. And so when I separate them, I know that I get one copy of each. But what happens in meiosis is the first thing that happens is I pair the two homologous chromosomes. So I have chromosome one for my mother and my father, and I bring those two together. It's a special process, and they have to be able to line up. And I don't think it's known exactly how it happens, but there are signals along the chromosome that let them be paired together. And then they get replicated, so I end up with a total of four chromosomes. So I have two, one and two are copies of each other, and they both, let's say, represent my mother's chromosome. Three and four are copies of each other, and they both came from my father. And then there are these exchange events that happen that let me end up with chromosomes that are a mixture of neither. So chromosome one no longer came exclusively from my mother. It came mostly from my mother and a little bit came from my father. But it increases the genetic diversity at each generation. It's quite accurate, because when you actually do this exchange, the final exchange event actually involves DNA of one from one parent inserting into the DNA of another parent, and they have to match up so the DNA is exactly complementary. So then there's the enzymes that come in and clip them and paste them back together again. And at that process, they've been lined up exactly. Right? You don't want to introduce errors at that rate. In fact, the errors due to meiosis are very small error rate due to that. I think it can happen anywhere. You measure where these things happen by looking at so-called recombination events, which you measure by how often is this piece of DNA and this piece of DNA get transferred together, and how often do they get separated into two different chromosomes, so-called genetic map distances. There are hot spots, and nobody knows exactly where that is. Probably has to do with some sequence signals that lead to hot spots of recombination. But I don't think there's been anything to show that it's more likely to happen within a gene or outside of a gene. It's pretty much scattered about. No, because remember, the genes are essentially the same sequence. I mean, they might have a change or two here and there, but by and large, they're the same sequence. And so it doesn't really happen. As long as the exchange event is reciprocal and of high fidelity, so I take the first half of gene X from my father and I attach it to the second half of gene X from my mother, I still have a perfectly good copy of gene X. As long as that exchange is faithful in terms of where the breakpoints and join points are, which that's quite well controlled, and it doesn't really create any problem. for the most part, they both can be expressed, but again, there are exceptions. One of the classic exceptions that's studied a lot is X chromosomes. Remember, males have one X chromosome, an X and a Y. Females have two X chromosomes, and so you might expect, all the genes on the X chromosome would be overexpressed in female world. In fact, what they do is they basically inactivate one of their X chromosomes, and that happens randomly. So with some cells, one of the X chromosomes will be inactivated, another one, a different X chromosome. But for any given cell, only one of those X chromosomes is active and the other one is inactive. And But for most genes, that's not true. For most chromosomes, because everybody, both male and female, everybody has two, both copies are active. Again, there are some a few exceptions, but I think they're relatively rare. Again, since they mostly code for the same products, it doesn't really matter if they're both on or off. In fact, that's a good point you just reminded me of, and that is most genetic diseases are called recessive, which means that in order for the disease, for you to have that disease, you have to have two bad copies of the gene. If all you need is one copy in order to be healthy, and if you got a good copy from your father, it doesn't matter if you got a bad copy from mother, because you still have one copy around. Now, that's not true of all genes. Some genes are dominant. That is, one bad copy will screw up the whole thing somehow. It has a dominant effect. But that's, for most genes, it's recessive. And that's because you only need one. If either one of the two genes is okay, you're okay. Yeah, they do the same thing too. Yeah. I have another picture that's same idea, a little more complex, but showing that it can happen in both things. There's no significant effect. And of course, I mean, it may even happen that one and two, but since they're direct copies, it doesn't matter if they exchange with each other, because they, you know, two has just been copied from one a second ago, so they're really the same. And if they did exchange, there would be no way for us to know that, because we can't, because as far as we know, they're identical to each other. It's noon. Should I keep going? I'm gonna talk this afternoon. I can sort of pick up at this point, or I could go on a little bit farther right now. Should I just pick up at this point in the afternoon and take a break for lunch? Okay.